2022. We're kicking the new year into high gear with a handful of heart-pounding suspense novels. This is Chapter 201 of WCBS Author Talks. I'm Lisa Cherenkovich, and coming up, Dirk Hustler shares the best piece of life and writing advice he's ever gotten from his best-selling father. Polar bears get a starring role in the new eco-thriller from Alice Henderson. Shay Earnshaw forces us to question everything we know in her adult fiction debut. Plus, a volcanic eruption in Hawaii unearths a body that should have stayed hidden, and the latest crime novel from Robert McCall. Fearless adventurer Dirk Pitt has been entertaining readers with his daring ocean escapades since the early 1970s, when he was first created by author Clive Cussler. Since 2004, Clive's son Dirk has written the books with him, and he continues to carry on the family business following Clive's death in 2020. I got to chat with Dirk about the latest installment in the action-packed series, The Devil's Sea. Tell us what readers can expect in this latest adventure.
Well, I hope it's a typical Pitt adventure that keeps the action going and the pages turning. We have Pitt in the Luzon Strait, which is north of the Philippines. He's just out doing his typical oceanographic survey work when he's called to try and locate a hypersonic missile that the Chinese had fired off and that had failed and crashed into the sea and holds great technological promise. A short time later, they discover, his kids discover some Tibetan artifacts in a plane wreck, and that leads into a whole different sort of historical chase into India to try and recover an ancient Tibetan relic that has significance both for the Tibetan Buddhist and the Dalai Lama, as well as the technological aspect of the hypersonic missile on the other side of the story. So hopefully it all ties together at the end.
You've brought Dirk's kids into this story, kind of like your dad brought you into Dirk's world. And why was the time really right to make Summer and Dirk Jr. integral to the exploits and the adventures going on?
Well, I think they've kind of taken a step up as the books have progressed. So he actually introduced them in Valhalla Rising, which was probably about 10 or 11 books ago. And so they've been a part of the series ever since then. And I think as they've aged maybe a bit, they were, I think, fresh out of college when he first introduced them. So maybe they're a little bit older now, a little bit more experienced and capable of sort of handling themselves and maybe their own adventures. So they can take kind of a larger role and at least a subplot as part of the books.
This book's release must be very bittersweet for you because it's the last one you co-wrote with your dad, right?
Well, actually, it isn't. The prior one was. So I really didn't have much interplay with my father on this one. He had passed really before I got really got into it. So this is kind of a standalone without him, I'm afraid.
How was that writing process for you? Because I know you guys used to write chapters and go back and forth and then come together and write together. It must have been so strange for you.
Yeah, especially at the front end. I mean, that's where we really did the most collaboration was in putting the plots together. We would work back and forth to generate ideas and try and come up with a plot and then produce an outline. And then I would typically go off and do the writing and then sort of feed him maybe 50 or 100 pages at a time. So I definitely missed his creative input at the front end of putting the story together because he was such an imaginative guy. And he always thought outside the box and could come up with some crazy and interesting ideas that make the stories fly. So I definitely missed that part of working with him when putting this one together.
What's the best piece of advice, writing or life-wise, that he ever gave you?
He used to say that if it ain't fun, it's not worth doing, was one of his favorite quotes. So, and I think he brought that to his writing, too. He wanted to make the books fun to read. They're entertaining. And so I think both maybe in trying to write the books and maybe living your life, I think that was not a bad philosophy to follow.
Did he ever think when he first started writing this series of books that it would last as long as it did and that people would want to keep coming back for more?
No, I think he had no idea. I mean, he used to say that he was just trying to write a little paperback potboiler series that give him the opportunity to be creative and do something that he liked to do. So he never imagined, I think, that it would become as popular as it did. It certainly lasted as long as it did. I'm sure that was a continuing surprise for him.
Is there ever any worry that as you continue the series that you'll run out of ideas, or there are just too many undiscovered and mysterious things out there in the world's oceans and bodies of water that that won't be the case?
Well, I think you touch on both elements, really. It's there. I mean, it's a tough challenge because of the canon of books. This is the 26th one. So it's certainly a challenge not to repeat yourself. But as you say, we're always finding out new things about the seas and the ocean and other technological discoveries that create sort of new elements of conflict or adventure. So hopefully we can keep it going. But it is a challenge to be fresh with it, no doubt.
And I know that you go out on these NUMA expeditions. Did whatever is found in those find their way into the books?
I think just once or twice. It's a good impetus for adding some realism to the stories when they're searching for a shipwreck and what it's like to dive down on a wreck and discoveries and so forth. So I think from a generic sense, it's very helpful to the writing. But I think there's only been maybe one or two wrecks that have actually been incorporated into the stories. So.
And I would hope it's not as dangerous and death-defying as the books make out that kind of exploration to be.
Yeah, right. We're not diving in the Himalayas or places like that. So, I think we generally try to be a little more safety conscious than they end up being in the stories, no doubt.
Or dodging bad guys left and right.
Right, getting shot at in a way, yeah.
Well, Dirk Kussler, thank you for joining us today to talk about the latest book in the series. It's Clive Cussler's The Devil's Sea. Can't wait to dive into it.
All right. Thank you so much, Lisa. I appreciate it.
In the last decade or so, polar bears have become the poster child of climate change. If you haven't been moved by images of solitary bears floating aimlessly on ice, then frankly, you don't have a heart. Author and wildlife researcher Alice Henderson knows what's at stake and harnesses the power of fiction to inform readers about the real-life dangers the world's polar bears face in her new eco-thriller, A Blizzard of Polar Bears. This is your second book featuring wildlife biologist / I like to say survivalist, Dr. Alex Carter. And your first book, if people aren't familiar with it, featured wolverines, which you said a lot of people didn't even realize were real animals. But I think it's safe to say no one's going to make that mistake with this book and the animals you feature in it.
Oh, I think that you're right. Polar bears are a lot more popular.
So what drew you to write about the plight of polar bears and the study and the research going into trying to save them for this book?
Well, I really wanted to choose species for this series. Each book is about a different species. And I really wanted to choose ones that are in particular peril right now. And the wolverine for my first book, there's actually less than 300 left in the lower 48. And for polar bears, of course, they've sort of become the face of climate change. The ice is breaking up much, much sooner every year and taking much longer to form in the fall. And polar bears starve during the summer months. So because this ice-free period is getting longer and longer, polar bears are starving for longer and longer. So I really wanted to bring attention to that plight and also talk about a lot of the neat facts about polar bears and hopefully have readers fall in love with these animals like I have.
What is the most interesting thing that you learned about them during your research? Or what is the one fact that you hope that readers take away from it and just be like, I never knew that?
There are so many neat facts. Like one is bears, like grizzly bears that live on land, will rub on trees to leave their scent so that other bears can find them. But on the ice, polar bears don't have anything like that. So they actually secrete scents through their paws, and they can leave these scent trails across the ice that enable them to do the same thing. They can follow a bear they want to meet and avoid a bear they don't want to meet.
That's really cool.
And another fascinating thing is polar bears will return to the same place to have cubs where they grew up. And the amazing thing is the ice is always changing and shifting, yet they are able to make it back to the same latitude and longitude to have their cubs. And it's something of a mystery of how they're able to do this. Since there's no landmarks they're following, obviously, and the ice is shifting. So scientists aren't quite sure how they're pulling this off. It's pretty neat.
All right, so forgive my ignorance here, but I am going to ask, is a group of polar bears really called a blizzard?
Well, when I came up with the idea for this series, I wanted each book to be the group name of the animal and the animal, but I seem to keep picking species that have no group name. Wolverines are so solitary that they don't gather in groups, so I had to make up a name for them and came up with a solitude because they're so solitary. And again, with polar bears, there are group names for bears in general, but not for specific species. So I threw out a few ideas to my editor about what a group name could be, perhaps a blizzard or frostbite or a whiteout, and we settled upon a blizzard.
Knowing that you made those up, it also just seems, it seems so appropriate and so fitting that I think science should adopt these terms for these animals.
That would be great.
How did you hit upon this idea of, you know, writing what's essentially, it's an eco-thriller. So it's really, it's engaging, it's exciting, there's a lot of action, there's a lot of twists and turns, but at the same time, we have such real science and research at its core, and it's so engaging. Like, for a lot of people, I think if they were to just pick up a nonfiction book about polar bears, they might not be as interested in what's going on as you make it out in these books. It's really ingenious in a way.
Thank you so much. I thought if I wrote a nonfiction book, say about wolverines or polar bears, that the only people that would pick them up might be people who were already very familiar or were on board with their conservation. And I wanted to reach a wider audience, and thrillers and suspense are my favorite thing to read, and action scenes are my favorite thing to write. And I'm also a wildlife researcher myself, and I was out in a remote wildlife sanctuary in Montana and doing some wildlife presence surveys. And the location was so remote and isolated. And I thought, why aren't I, you know, bringing these two worlds together? I'm a writer. I'm a wildlife researcher. I could write these suspenseful tales, and each one could be set in a different place about a different animal. And I really got inspired to create this series so that I could shed light on these animals' plights, but also tell a thrilling narrative that hopefully will keep readers engaged.
And I do hope for your sake you never come across one of these situations that Dr. Carter does.
Me too.
And so, like I said, these books are really entertaining, but they also feel like a call to arms. And I wanted to ask you, what can people do if, after reading this book or even just listening to this interview, to help polar bears and other endangered species?
Well, in the back of each book, I have a section about where you can go to learn more and even their volunteer opportunities. And I would say that there's a lot of things people can do as individuals and as communities. I think there's a tendency to feel pretty hopeless right now and to feel like the problem is so insurmountable. But one thing people can do is encourage their representatives in Congress to pass things like the Pond Fin Conservation Act, which can restore and strengthen the Endangered Species Act, and also encourage them to pass legislation for renewable energy. And you can also do things in your own personal life. For example, eating less meat is a huge one that can go toward tackling climate change. You know, have, say, a meatless Saturday with your family. And another cool thing you can do to really feel personally engaged is engage in some citizen science. There's so many neat projects out there that you can do either from your computer, say you can count rhinos on remote cameras in Africa from your computer, or you can go out into the field and say count monarch butterflies, or keep track of snowfall in your area or how the environment is changing, how precipitation is changing, and upload that to scientists who can then use that data to get some good legislation going. There's a neat polar bear project in particular you can do if you find yourself up in the Arctic. It's called the Whisker Print Project. And you can take a profile shot of a bear's muzzle on your camera, and with a large telephoto, of course. And each polar bear on its muzzle, because their skin is black and their fur is transparent, when their whiskers grow out, they have a unique pattern of black spots that you can see their skin through their fur. And if you take a photo of this, it's a way to identify individual bears and their movements. And it's a great way to non-invasively track the movement of bears and keep track of where individuals are.
I'm glad you clarified long telephoto lens, because I was going to ask, you can't get that close, can you?
And would not be advisable, no.
So have you settled on the next animal you plan to write about?
I have, and in fact, I just turned the manuscript into my editor. I decided upon mountain caribou. You know, most people think of caribou, they think of those, the caribou that are barren ground caribou that live in Alaska and the Yukon, and they roam in these vast herds of thousands. But mountain caribou are less well known, and they're a thing all their own. They have very small herds, usually less than 50. And instead of living on the tundra, they live in these steep mountains. And they'll climb up the mountain in the winter and use the tall snowpack to stand on. And they survive by pulling lichen off of tree limbs. So they have their own unique ecological niche. And we used to have them here in the lower 48, and they went extinct here in 2019. So I really want to address their plight and what they're facing and how we can help them.
And it's so funny, because having read A Blizzard of Polar Bears, if there's anybody out there who doubts that you can make mountain caribou a thrilling story, they do not know what you're capable of, because I know it's going to be enthralling.
Thank you so much. That's a great compliment.
We've been talking with Alice Henderson. Like I said, the new book is A Blizzard of Polar Bears. Thank you for your time today, and also for really working hard to bring the plight of these animals to light.
My absolute pleasure, and I'm honored to be your guest today. Thank you.
You know, I have a rule about spoilers on this podcast. Namely, I don't say anything because I want you to be surprised if you decide to pick up one of the books I feature. But I have to tell you, it was really, really hard not to divulge any of the numerous twists and turns featured in Shay Earnshaw's adult fiction debut, A History of Wild Places. There are just so many of them. Take a listen to our interview and you'll see what I mean. There are so many layers to this story. We have someone who has a special talent for finding the missing, go missing himself. And he's looking for an author of a best-selling series who disappeared 5 years earlier. There's a secret society where a charismatic leader who's living off the grid. I mean, what was the inspiration behind this whole story?
I actually grew up not far from Antelope, Oregon, which is a small town where a community called Rajneeshpuram was established back in the 80s. And the community was actually featured in a documentary on Netflix called Wild, Wild Country, for any listeners who've watched it or are interested in learning more about it. But so growing up not far from there, it was in the news quite a bit. You know, neighbors were talking about it. And I remember the day when my father had seen a series. Well, it was more like a fleet. I think it was about 24 Rolls Royces that were being driven out to the community. And I remember being really fascinated by the juxtaposition of that. You know, this community was living off the land. They were attempting to live a simpler way of life, and yet the leader of the community had ordered all these Rolls Royces. And I had a lot of questions that really stuck with me for most of my life, and I think that really sparked my fascination with communities like this and wanting to better understand if it's possible for a community like this to exist. Is it sustainable, or is it destined to fail? And I think it's a really fascinating social experiment that I really wanted to dig into in this book.
And really, without giving too much away, you play with how much people can be manipulated or led to believe a certain set of things or fact. And it's really kind of scary.
I agree. And you are right. This book is a difficult one to talk about without giving anything away. But yeah, I really wanted to play on this idea of, can you trust your own thoughts? Can you trust the people around you? And, you know, our world isn't always what we think it is. And I really wanted my characters to question the world around them and question their own mind, ultimately, in the story. And through the unraveling of this book, we really come to learn that probably none of the characters should have trusted anything around them.
And I know this is your first foray into adult fiction, and I guess it kind of makes sense that you've been sitting on this story for so long, but it really doesn't seem like you'd really be able to really get into the meat of it in a YA kind of novel.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, and I started writing this book back in 2017, and I worked on it slowly throughout the years as I was writing other young adult novels. And so it's a story that took me a while to write, I think, because it really does deal with some pretty deep, intense topics. And I wanted to make sure I did that right. But yeah, it really isn't a story that I think I could have explored as a young adult novel.
I know I kind of ran through at the top a few of the little plot points or things to look for. Knowing that this is a book that's hard to talk about, what are you saying to potential readers to entice them to pick it up?
You know, I think it's really a book about fairy tales in a lot of ways. But it's also a book about finding what home means for us. For the characters, that's something that they each struggled with. You know, where do they belong? What is home to them? And, you know, I think there's some dark themes in this story, but ultimately I hope that readers come away at the end feeling like they have a better sense of their own place, their own home in the world. And, you know, maybe questioning their surroundings a bit, but ultimately, I think it is about finding where we each belong.
I'm glad you said fairy tales, because my next question is about this book within a book that you've written, because you do have an author who's disappeared, and she's known for these kind of fantastical kid books, I guess, in a way. And as I was reading your book, I was wondering, is this allegory? Is this maybe your way of trying to bridge the gap between your young adult novels? And yes, this is now my adult novel. What does this book within a book serve for you?
Yeah, it was a nice segue, I suppose, in writing about a children's book author in my adult fiction novel. But ultimately, I wanted readers to ask the question as to whether Maggie was real or not. By providing these snippets of the books that Maggie, this fictional character, has written, I wanted readers to log in online and look and see if her book series really exists. And, you know, although it does feel rather fitting that she's a children's book author and I have written YA, I think Maggie really is what I have always hoped that an author would be like. You know, she's very reclusive and secretive and enigmatic, and she's full of mystery. And I hope there's still authors like her out there in the world. I know I'm not like that, but but I love the idea that she's this author who vanished before her sixth and final book was written. And in the book, there's some speculation as to whether she did this on purpose. Was it a publicity stunt? Of course, I've had some people, you know, comment to me, am I going to vanish before a Hister Well Places releases, you know, to pull my own publicity stunt? I am not, at least I hope not. But yeah, I think she also was a really fun character to write in that sense, because I was able to tap into some of my own background as a writer and as an author. So it was a fun book to write for a lot of reasons, but that was definitely one of them.
If you do disappear, we have one of the last exclusive interviews.
Yes, that is right.
You know, I think
you'll be questioned later.
Yeah, well, but so for your sake and my sake, we'll hope that doesn't happen.
Yes. Thank you.
I think, you know, a lot of people have probably thought about, you know, dropping out of their crazy, hectic lives and maybe trying to live a simpler life. Is that something you've daydreamed about?
Oh, of course. I mean, weekly, I would say. You know, and I suppose the last couple of years, some of us have been forced to experience that in some form or another. But yeah, I think the idea of especially going and living in a community like Pastoral, which is the fictional community in my book, you know, there's a lot that's appealing about that lifestyle. You know, it's a much slower pace of life. It's sort of an honest, good pace of life. And then ultimately what happens in the book is we realize that the same sort of corruption we see in the outside world sort of creeps into these small communities anyway. So maybe there really is no escaping some of the trials and tribulations of our modern culture and society. But yeah, I think the idea of creating a slower pace of life is nice sometimes. But then I also, you know, I crave social media like the rest of us, and I get pulled back in. But I want readers to ask that question as well. I hope readers read the book and ask themselves, would they want to live in a community like Pastoral? Is that a type of life that they could live for a time?
I was going to ask, you know, what would you miss most? But I think you answered that question. For me, it would probably be running water.
Yeah. You know, some of those modern conveniences that we often take for granted can be pretty nice, you know, although I do think we would adapt fairly quickly as well. So I think it would be an interesting experiment for a short time, but maybe not forever.
I think if I didn't know any better that there was, let's say, running water in the outside world, I would learn to adapt. But if I knew that that was still there, it'd be really tough.
Right, right. Yeah, it's that ignorance is bliss old saying, you know, as soon as you know what you could have, it's hard to give that up.
So now one reviewer described your book as ripe for a miniseries. Has there been any interest?
You know, there's been a few murmurings behind the scene. I will say for those who've read the book, you know that this would be a challenging book to adapt into film or TV. There are some things I got away with in writing the book because the reader couldn't see what was really happening. So I could keep the curtain halfway pulled. And in an adaptation format, it would be tricky. It's possible, you know, we've had some discussions and it could be done, but it would be a delicate balance for sure.
Definitely,
without giving anything away here.
Definitely some creative screenwriting would have to help you out there. But then again, you know,
you're exactly right.
I love having read a book and knowing that a book is almost that difficult to adapt only because that's what makes books so great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a medium that does allow you to do certain things that you can only do in book form. And I really took liberties with that on this book.
Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Hopefully we've enticed a few other people to go and pick it up and see what it's all about. We've been talking with Shay Earnshaw. The book is A History of Wild Places. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me, Lisa. This was a lot of fun.
If the winter weather has you yearning for someplace tropical, the Hawaiian setting featured in Robert McCall's Kowakane detective series is just the ticket. Treachery Times 2 is the fourth book in the series, and Robert started out our interview by catching us up on the action we've missed thus far.
Koa starts off as a chief detective in the Hilo, Hawaii Police Department. He frequently deals with murder cases, and he has a very interesting backstory in that as a teenager, he had an altercation with his father's nemesis, and in the ensuing fight, killed the man. He killed him in a remote cabin. After spending a lot of time thinking about and trying to figure out how he was going to extricate himself from this position, he decided to cover up the crime by faking a suicide. So there are four independent stories. You can essentially read them in any order that you want. There are a few references back and forth, but this fourth book, you see two different stories woven together. One is a story about his backstory, because the grandson of the man he kills comes to the Big Island and starts asking questions. And as he asks more and more questions, Koa is literally forced to investigate his own crime. And step by step by step, his cover-up of what he did as a teenager comes perilously close to being forced into disclosure. That's one story. And the other story involves his friend, who's the senior military police officer at Pohakaloa, which is the largest U.S. military base in the Pacific, which is in the process in the book of testing a super weapon called Deimos. And he gets drawn into an espionage investigation involving the corruption of Deimos.
I love how this book opens in really the most Hawaiian of fashions, which is a volcanic earthquake that unearths a grave that a killer thought that they had hidden pretty well.
Absolutely. And it's interesting to me that so much of Hawaii, and I'm talking about the Big Island now, which is the largest of the Hawaiian islands, is driven by its volcano activity. I mean, it's from the 1980s until 2018 was one of the longest continuous eruptions in recorded human history. So Pele, who is the personification of the Hawaiian volcano, is really an important legend, an important myth in Hawaii. And people speak about Pele as though she was in the room. I mean, it's a reference to the volcano that affects people's lives every day. And one of the things I've done in all four books, at least I hope I've done, is Hawaii itself is a character. Not the Hawaii that you see on Waikiki or West Maui, but what I call the real Hawaii, the people with extreme ethnic diversity that you see in Hawaii, with a miracle, beautiful language that you hear spoken, with a very tortured history of relationships with the United States, which expropriated the islands. And with all of the problems that we see in other parts of the country, but with a special tilt in Hawaii because of its extreme isolation geographically and its very peculiar history with the United States.
It's obvious in your writings that you have this love for Hawaii. And I was curious, what's your connection?
Well, it's actually interesting. I went to Hawaii, to the Big Island, for the first time in the 80s, and I just kind of fell in love with the place. There's a magic to the mountains. There's a magic to the diversity. Where I actually was standing on a beach at sunset with palm trees behind me. And I turn around and I look away from the ocean, and there are the palm trees. And then in the distance, there's Mauna Kea, which is snow-capped. And because it's snow-capped, the red from the sunset has turned the top of the mountain red. It just was a magical moment for me. And I started going back to Hawaii again and again. I started traveling all of the back roads. I did what many, many Hawaiians do every day, which is to talk story, which is, everything from what you did this morning to a story about one of the Hawaiian myths. I met some police officers out there. I met a lot of people who helped me understand the culture and the history. I did a lot of research, and the more I learned, the more I wanted to share this with readers. And I was a lawyer. I practiced a lot of litigation and criminal law. I knew how to dig out facts. That was one of the most important things that I did, and I'd always loved mysteries, and so it all came together as a way of telling people about Hawaii, wrapped up in what I hope are interesting and fun, and sometimes surprising mysteries.
I want to get back to this latest mystery because, you know, it's a really entertaining read. It has everything you expect a police procedural murder mystery to have, twists and turns, things that you don't expect, you know, really great characters. But I know that you've said that this story in particular explores two of your favorite themes, which are human flaws and the compulsion to hide misdeeds. And you really do give readers some pause as you're reading this, as you're trying to figure out how you feel about Koa and what he's done in the past and how he's tried to rectify that in the present.
One of the things that I discovered in practice is that human beings have this incredible desire to hide what they perceive as their flaws or their wrongdoing. One of my favorite stories about this is that I represented a guy in testimony. And as I was preparing him, I asked him, have you ever been arrested or convicted of a crime? And I got this wishy-washy, waffling answer. And my instincts told me that there was something there. And this guy was going to go in. I knew he was going to get asked this question, had he ever been arrested? And it was perfectly clear to me that he was hiding something. And that he was probably prepared to lie about it. And I pushed him, and I pushed him. And finally he said, I'm just so embarrassed. He said, I was once arrested for illegal duck hunting. And I thought to myself, here's a man who was almost prepared to go into formal testimony and commit perjury, because he was ashamed of the fact that he had once gone duck hunting in some illegal way. And it just, for me, it personified this notion that we want to hide from any criticism of what we've done in the past. And that's a driving factor in a lot of human conduct, and it's a godsend for authors because it gives you lots to play with. So that's one of the themes that I really like.
We've been talking with Robert McCall. The new book is Treachery Times Two. It's a great read, especially, you know, as we're getting into the long nights of winter and you're dreaming of someplace warmer and nicer.
Well, that's true, because the weather in Hawaii is generally very nice, except it's been very bad this past week.
Robert, thank you for your time today.
Well, thank you very much, Lisa, for having me. It's a real pleasure to chat with you, and I hope that your readers enjoy Treachery Times, too.
And that's where we close the book on this chapter. Next time, we tackle that New Year's resolution to get fit from a different angle by diving into the history of women's fitness. Until then, bend down, pick up that phone, and lift it. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at WCBS880Books. I'm Lisa Cherkovich.